I'm Michael Brennis, and this is the Showbiz Roundup. If you stop in at the Uptowner in Milwaukee on any given Tuesday, you'll be treated to the Dave Bayless Trio, working it out, keeping it spontaneous and real. If you happen to hear the gears grinding and skipping a bit as they engage, it's because they've invited you into the creative process in real time, which is a rare thing indeed. We've talked a bunch with Russ Johnson over the last couple of years. I thought today we'd focus our attention on the rhythm section of the Dave Bayless Trio. Dave Bayless and Clay Schwab, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The trio has had a long-standing residency every Tuesday at the Uptowner in Milwaukee. How long have you guys been playing there? Has it always been the three of you? How did it start?
Well, I played there probably 20 years ago with a guitarist named Bill Martin, and he had a trio there, and I did that gig after a drummer here in town had left to go to Chicago, Mike Schlick, and I did that gig for a while, and that was back when smoking was permitted in clubs, and you know, the smoke, they were serious smokers there. So eventually it got too much for me and my lungs, and I stopped doing it and did other things for a long time. And then, it, I don't know, 20, 21 years later-ish, I was teaching at the Milwaukee Jazz Institute, which has their classrooms right up the street at the Jazz Gallery. And Eric Jacobson and myself went over there just to have a beer, and there was the owner, and we started talking. We sit in the same seat I remember him sitting in 21 years ago, and we started talking, and one thing led to another, and he said, "Do you want to play here again?" And I said, "Sure," you know. And so it went through a couple different people, and then the pandemic shut us down. And that was an interesting period of time for me where I thought, okay, I've done all these different things. I feel like I need to fill some musical void that I was kind of feeling. And so I thought about Russ, because Russ and I were both teaching at UW Parkside. And I had actually known Russ since around 1981 maybe, and but we didn't really play together that much, and of course he spent a lot of time in New York. And anyway, so make a long story short, I wanted to play with Russ. I knew Russ was into a slightly different thing than I was into, and I was curious about it. I had heard it enough times, and then Clay was a great choice for me. We've worked together in a lot of different situations, and I thought that would be a good trio, and it turns out it has been, I feel. So that's kind of how that started. We've been there since around 2021, Clay, is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know exactly when we started playing there, but it's been a couple of years.
I saw a recording from 2021 recently, so somewhere on that time.
It's funny, you know, we don't think about the smoking ban all that much. You just reminded me of that. I guess it was like 2006 or something, the statewide smoking ban. But before that, you know, for those of us who are not smokers and playing in clubs, like, I don't know if you ever played in Restaurant Magnus, for example, here in Madison.
I sure have.
But man, by the end of the night, that place was just blue. And I'm with you. At that time, I was like, how much longer can I keep doing this? And, you know, these days, I think people kind of forget that was what, you know, the conditions musicians were playing in here we are, what, I don't know, 15, 16 years later, we don't even think about that, man. Those, it's like workplace safety or something.
Well, and then also this, that the hours, well, at the Uptown, it wasn't too late, but, you know, a lot of these gigs went to 1:30, 2 in the morning. And, you know, that's changed too. I mean, now it's like, oh, 10, it goes to 10 o'clock, 11. Oh, that's pretty late, you know.
Things are very civilized these days, it seems. You're not packing out of the club at 2 o'clock and then fighting through all the drunk drivers to get home. Tell us about the music that the trio plays. What's your repertoire consist of? Who's bringing in the material? How do you make decisions about how to interpret the music you're playing? Who's running the show?
Well, the composers are Russ and Clay, and they are way better composers than I am. And, you know, Clay, both of these guys are just, I feel really, I mean, I'm just embarrassed to bring my stuff in at this point, but I will get there. It's on my list. You know, and in terms of like interpreting it, I think the composers interpret it and tell us, but we, you know, we've only had like 2 rehearsals in the entire time we've been together, and we need some more, but I'll let Clay address his composing skills.
No, I think, yeah, it's just whoever brings in the tunes. I think probably of all the repertoire, maybe a third is mine, maybe a third is Russ's, and the other third is kind of like Monk tunes or stuff by Charlie Hayden or Jerry Allen we've been doing. You know, some just kind of stuff that fits kind of within the feeling of what we're trying to convey. You know, this kind of freer, a little bit more open thing. And, you know, with whatever, we're trying to choose whatever songs are going to be appropriate for this trio, you know, for Dave, for Russ, and for me playing in this style. So, and the composing is, you know, just what, I mean, for me, it's what composing always is. Some of it's super inspired, and I work on one tune for, you know, 6 months. And that, you know, so it's a lot of craft. And then other pieces, it's like, okay, that'll come to me and I'll have an idea and I'll just sketch it out. And I will even show up with just kind of these sort of a little bit unfinished tunes, and we run with it. You know, as Russ has told me in the past, he said, you know, just commit and go, you know, both in terms of the improvising, but also in terms of the composing, where it's just like, well, I have this idea, I'm not quite sure how it's going to work, let's try it. Okay. And I show up and we do it. And some of it works. Some of it works really well. Some of it doesn't work. And then, so then it's like, okay, scrap that one. And, you know, we're building up quite a big stack of tunes now. It takes us a long time to sort out what we're going to play before each set because there's so much music. And so, you know, some of that stuff is really good. Some of it, yeah, you know, we can let go. And that's fine. But it's been really fun to try to keep generating new material because, yeah, we've had this gig for now quite a while. And so, you know, to try to keep bringing things in and think of new ideas about, okay, what different sounds can we make? What different textures can we make with just the three of us, you know? So.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for getting ideas out of the queue to make space for the next idea to come in. I'm a big proponent of that stuff.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with you. Yeah.
It's interesting that you are playing like Monk tunes, stuff Jerry Allen, you know, legendary piano players, and yet there's no chordal instrument in the band.
Yeah, that's also another inspiration that I've been drawing on a lot are those chordless trios of Sonny Rollins, like the in some sense that what is
State
it?
Of
what
the Tenor?
No, well, yeah, that would be one too, but East Broadway Rundown is what I've been thinking of a lot. Even though it's trumpet and not tenor, it's just kind of, I love that stuff. I grew up listening to that stuff, and that was like anyway, that's been speaking to me recently for this trio to try to go that direction. Yeah.
Dave, it looked like you were getting ready to tell us something there.
I it was funny when he said we're getting a stack of music. I know this is a radio and you can't see this visual right now, but this is sort of like the, let's see. I mean, it just kind of keeps going and going. All this music, and
it's like a ream. That's a full ream.
Yeah, right, that's a full ream. And there's and there's another pile of tunes that at least I need to rehearse with the guys. We maybe tried it and it was a disaster or something, or not as great as I wanted to. But you know, the other thing that's been great from this trio is that you know, both Clay and Russ, and I feel this way too, is we've got this steady gig, and I do want to take chances. I mean, someone says, you want to play this tune? It's like, okay, yeah, let's do it. And we sight read a lot of stuff, and sometimes it goes really well, and other times for me, not as well as I'd liked it to have. But I think the trust has developed over a period of almost, you know, of 2 years, which is, that's great. I mean, that doesn't, to me, that's important. And you try stuff and we might discuss it after the gig or the next time around or whatever, or not. And sometimes a lot of things don't have to be said because you just know, yeah, that didn't work. But I don't want to be too conservative either. I want to, you know, we're humans. We make mistakes. We just recently did a live recording session at the Uptowner. And I'm going through those. We recorded about 11 compositions, which is, I don't even know how to put this thing out anymore. I mean, CDs, my students don't even know what CDs are, you know. So, but there's a lot of music there, and kind of listening to it back again as from a listener standpoint instead of the participant, it's kind of interesting to me how, in some ways, transparent it is with that instrumentation, no chordal instrument, and kind of, and I don't know how you feel about this, Clay, but kind of the responsibility of each person is like heightened. Because there's, you can't hide for a second behind a pianist or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. I think and also the freer nature of what we're doing, you know, there's not necessarily, I think about this a lot when I'm playing tunes, you know, a standards gig, which I absolutely love to do. It's like there's a clear path before me. I know exactly what I got to do. I just got to play the changes. I got to play with good time. I got to, and so much of that also applies to this other freer music. But you also have to bring with it like your own creative ear, your own kind of discerning ability, or as Russ was saying before, like as I said before, just commit. So you got to bring energy, right? You got to bring like this drive, this direction, commit and go. I'm gonna like play, this is where we're going, you know, and communicating that through music. And so all of that, it just becomes a really interesting process to you know, to grow and to grow, to have this trio happening over a long scale of time, to keep saying, okay, I'm gonna put that energy out there week after week after week. And some weeks we've hit really amazing high. Holy cow, I can't believe what we just said, you guys. This was amazing, you know, and you can feel it in the audience, and you can feel it, you know, through Russ and Dave and just the trio. And then other weeks it's like, you know, now we're dragging or we're scuffling to get by, you know. And so it's a cool litmus test, or it's a cool, you know, baseline for just how things are going musically. And the recording was a challenge because there was a lot of music to get through. Some of it was new for us. Some of it was very difficult. Some of the tunes Russ wrote was pretty challenging. And so, you know, we did it. I'm excited to hear what it sounds like when we finally have it on record, or when we finally have them all lined up, you know, in an order and mixed and mastered and polished and all that. So anyway.
Yeah, I think I just want to point out for our listeners that when Dave and Clay are being, they're being humble in the way that musicians tend to be, that when they say that they're struggling with something, or, you know, something's challenging, or, you know, this, we didn't dig this as much as we did this other thing, you know, they're just being humble. It's all good. It's all good. It's all part of the process. And from an audience perspective, you know, some of those things I think audiences really dig too, like hearing the band come together in real time, you know, like you can feel them working and collaborating and cooperating and stuff. I think audiences really dig that.
Yeah, my friend Mark Davis, you know, the pianist, he talks about Thelonious Monk like that, that you can hear the gears working, right? You can you're listening to him and you can hear him sorting it out, like figuring out how all these parts fit together. And yeah, for us sometimes as a trio, it's like that. We're like, oh, wait, and then, yeah, and it's not necessarily a problem, but it is, you know, that is what's happening, you know. So, yeah, anyway, fun.
Dave, you've been a music educator for many, many years. Fill us in on that part of your career. Where are you teaching? In what capacity? And did you start out with that as a goal for your career?
A goal? No, I don't think so. I always felt like I was a player first. Although I did, well, I went to school in Colorado, and it was a very, really good school, but it was also, music education was a big part of it. And I was 18, and I just couldn't see myself being a teacher. I was 18, you know, I wanted to play. So anyways, it was also a very good performance school, Northern Colorado. Anyways, I came back to Milwaukee. I started gigging around, and my mother was a Milwaukee public school teacher. She taught fourth grade, and my dad was a photographer. And so I turned out to be kind of a combination of both of them. You know, I teach, and my dad was a photographer. I'm not a photographer, but freelance musician, I guess. And I guess opportunities came knocking in a way, and I, you know, like most of us, right, we don't say no to a music gig. And I started teaching at University of Wisconsin Parkside in Kenosha in 2000, and I've been there since then, that time. And then I was at UW Milwaukee twice, and I'm back there again for the last 8 years. And they're both kind of similar jobs in that I teach percussion at both places, although specialized in drum set at UW Milwaukee versus general percussion at UW Parkside. And I teach a jazz appreciation class, some theory, basic theory, classical theory classes. And at UWM the past 2 years, I started a Latin jazz group there with another student, and we both have a love for Latin music. I still play with a Latin jazz group, and then so we started that group, and that's been just really one of the highlights of my teaching career, I guess. The students are amazing. They are really like young professionals. I mean, not necessarily all musically I'm talking, but I mean just courtesy, communication, and enthusiasm, and a love and respect for each other that I haven't seen in a long time. So that's been fun. And then just actually almost a week and a half ago, I was named a jazz ensemble director there too. So that's I filled in at the last minute. I had 2 days notice that the jazz director was leaving, and would you be interested in, you know, taking over? And I'm like, yes, of course. And so it's been a challenging semester, but I enjoyed it. And so I guess they're gonna continue with me, and I'm looking forward to it. So yeah, I do that and I play. So it's like kind of 50-50. I kind of like both, although sometimes it gets a little heavy in teaching and my practicing suffers. But you know, there's only 24 hours, so just got to deal with it. Clay and I are both involved in the Milwaukee Jazz Institute, which, you know, I've known Mark for almost 30 years. Mark Davis is a musical director, and there's some amazing things going on there too. So it's, I don't know, musically it's been really, I've been very fortunate.
Clay, what do you do when you're, aside from Milwaukee Institute, what do you do when you're not on the bandstand?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have a handful of bass students, you know. There's not quite as much interest in upright bass, you know, in jazz bass, but I have a handful of bass students. I also teach the Alexander technique, which is about posture, breathing, and movement. And it, I got into that because I have had struggled with carpal tunnel syndrome from playing bass for so long. And I raised two daughters, you know, and plant a garden, and all the good things, man. But I also practice a lot, you know. So, yeah, I've been kind of in these years of my life when I have two kids, and so they are occupying a lot of my time. I get a couple hours each day to do what I need to do, and it's like bang, 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 bang. I got to do my stuff. So I'm doing my practicing and, you know, sending whatever emails, and then it's time to be with the kids for the afternoon, and then in the evening it's off to the gig. So, and it's great. It's been a wonderful balance.
Dave, you've been an enduring presence on the Milwaukee jazz scene for many, many years. You talked about school in Colorado. You've also worked, I think, in some other places around the country. What convinced you to either come back to Milwaukee or to continue your career in Milwaukee?
I've been here the whole time, really. I mean, like, why I left Colorado was just, didn't know what I want to do with my life, you know, which is a good lesson when I run into an 18-year-old and they do some, you know, some things. I go, I wonder why they're doing that. And then I go, well, I used to do that, you know. So, you know, it's difficult, especially in music, you know. Do you, you know, you might have some parents that support you and what you do. And I was lucky. I did have two parents that were very supportive of what I was doing. Always concerned. I think parents are always concerned. What are they going to do with that? What are they going to do with that? You know, but no, I just found, I found really great players here, great opportunities. I had thought probably like a lot of people do, you know, do I move to New York? Do I move to the West Coast? You know? And, I don't know. I just chose here. No regrets, really. I mean, it is what it is, you know? So yeah, I've had some things that I feel have kept me going musically, and, Milwaukee's a affordable city, and state of Wisconsin's pretty beautiful. So yeah, that's why I'm here, yeah. I guess.
And Clay, you appeared on the Milwaukee scene, I want to say maybe 10 years ago. You can correct me if I'm wrong. Tell us how you arrived in Milwaukee. Where were you before? And how are things going for you now that you're here?
Yeah. Well, I'm from New Mexico. That's where I grew up. I went to school in Colorado, traveled around for a couple of years after finishing music school. I lived in New York for 5 years and was playing jazz and going to Alexander School out there. And I love New York. It was an amazing experience. Very difficult place to make a living and to survive. But the jazz was so awesome. I lived in this building, which they lovingly referred to as the Jazz Dorms, which was 99 Ocean Avenue in Brooklyn. And there's about, I don't know, 40 or 50 musicians living in this single building. And jazz musicians. And then next door, there's another building like that, which was also the same. And it, so you'd go down and get your mail, and somebody would say, hey, man, I'm having a session this afternoon. Are you free? You know, can you play? Or, you know, hey, I got a gig for you. Oh, hey, so I'm, you know, whatever. And it was, so this is really a wonderful community of very highly skilled jazz musicians there. And so I lived there for 5 years and got some stuff together. But then my wife got a job with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra playing flute and piccolo here, and she got tenure. And at that point, it was like, well, do I stay in New York or do I leave? And I chose to come here to Milwaukee. And yeah, that was in 2012, I think, 2013 maybe. And yeah, so I've been here 10 years and I've just been working steadily since then. You know, it, as whenever you move to a new place, it kind of takes a while to get established and to get to know what the scene is and who, you know, who to meet and where to go and all that. So it took a little while, but now I'm playing a lot. And as much as I, as really as much as I care to play, and I feel super lucky and super blessed. And I've met so many wonderful musicians in Milwaukee. The level is surprisingly high, you might say. There's some really great players here. And so so I don't really feel hemmed in by the size of the scene, maybe because I'm playing so much or because I get to play with such good musicians like Russ and Dave and Pamela York and Eric Jacobson and Mark Davis. All these guys are wonderful, and I'm lucky that I get to play with them so often. So anyway, that's pretty much my story.
And I'm glad you're here too, man. Cause he was going to move to Australia, weren't you?
Yeah. My wife also she was offered a position in Australia and we were going to go there. And anyway, it didn't work out with the visas. So we decided we couldn't pull it off. I think for me personally, we probably dodged a bullet because we were going to move. That would have been in 2019, and we would have just gotten there, and COVID would have happened. And also that summer prior to that, they had that the Black Summer where a lot of Eastern Australia burned, and it was like a really intense summer of really intense fires and smoke. Then they came right out of that and they went into COVID. So then my wife, with a job that my wife would have had, actually shut down. And it still is not really back up and going. So, yeah, I think we dodged a bullet. But what an amazing, beautiful place. I wrote one tune that we play with the trio about where I would go when we were in Australia, where I would go to hear a bunch of live music in Melbourne at this neighborhood called Fitzroy. And I tried to write the tune in the sound of what I remembered hearing there. And those guys were really good. The Australian musicians that I met and heard were incredible and playing in a really modern way that was really interesting to me. So anyway, yeah.
Clay, I don't think I knew that story behind Fitzroy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what it is.
it takes a Zoom call to
Yeah. Well, maybe you guys would know if you ever rehearsed.
Yeah. Maybe.
But that's so typical of, you know, bands that have residencies and stuff. You know, it's same with me too. Like it's so hard to find time to rehearse, and, you know, it's almost better to do it on the bandstand in many ways.
Yeah. And also I think we're trying to keep the music, a lot of this stuff anyway, super spontaneous. Right. So it's kind of, it's not like we're trying to ignore the thing. We're actually just trying to, well, I don't know, maybe in some sense it would be better, but we're also trying to keep it of the moment. So there's a one aspect of that.
You know? You guys have been on the scene long enough to understand sort of trends in the way that especially live creative music is valued in our society. And I don't know if your viewpoint is different than mine, but it feels to me like it's less valued by society now, but that might not be true. I mean, historically, maybe it's always been kind of underground or however you want to put it. Do you have any thoughts about the future of this music, especially live music, and maybe some insights for younger players coming up in the scene? What's your prognosis?
You know, your question's timely because I'm reading my final exams in my jazz appreciation class. And the question is, what do you think jazz will sound like in 2099 based on what you've learned in class and following the trends? And so, you know, a lot of the young students, and these are not music majors. These are just, you know, it's a gen ed course. And so a lot of them are talking about electronics being, you know, the way music, jazz music is going to sound, and maybe the instruments, some say they'll go away and some say, oh, they can never go away. It's part of it. So it's interesting. I guess what I've learned from it is that it's my perspective of what jazz will be may not be at all close to what's really going to happen. I think as long as there's some sort of culture and soul in our civilization, and what I mean by culture, I don't necessarily mean it's all good. I mean, we're always going to have rubs. We have it right now. We've had it for a long time. I think jazz responds to that in some way. That's one aspect. That's one reason people write and play a certain way. But then there's other reasons for expressing yourself, like Clay, responding to a moment in his life in Australia, and that music, that particular tune is one of our best tunes. It's amazing. So it's a happy song. I don't know what it's going to sound like, Michael. I mean, is the value getting worse or better? You know, when I first started off, older musicians would say, "Oh, don't go into music. It's now that the big band era has ended, there's nothing left, and that's just not true. I think as long as people are going to be making music, there'll be a place to play it. Will it be as popular as like the big band era? Probably never again. But I don't know. I'm not sure I want it to be popular. And everybody's going to be jumping on that, and we're going to get, a night of sampled music, by pushing buttons. I don't think that's what jazz is, in my opinion. It's hard to say. I honestly don't know. Maybe Clay has a better take on it.
I don't know. I'm a bit of an optimist. I think people like jazz, actually. I think it always changes. It always morphs. Each individual brings something new to it. And I think there will continue to be, kind of individuals in this music that kind of thrust themselves up like mountain ranges, if you want to call it, put it that way, and create something for themselves because they love music, because they value that for themselves and for the world at large. I think in the 70s, things were looking pretty bleak for jazz, and along came a whole generation of great musicians, Carl Allen, Wynton Marsalis, all those people. You had this, this kind of 90s boom, right? And then in the 2000s, Brad Meldow and all that stuff. So there's always, and then in terms of creative, like really creative stuff, the stuff out of ECM. And I mean, people have been saying jazz is dead for a long time, and it's not dying. It just continues to go on. It changes. It changes a lot.
It sure does.
But I think that kind of like, as long as humans have a desire to create, as long as humans have, an innate desire to make something, this music, the history of jazz now has given them a vehicle to do that, And I think that's when you tap into that, people respond to it and people are into it. Yeah, it may never be super popular. It's not going to be, it's not going to be your milk and cookies, but it might be the nourishing food that you need,
One thing that's interesting along those lines, when we recorded, what was that, about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, we took another day to record some of the very, very soft tunes that we do. We did that on a Monday, and then we recorded live on Tuesday. And one of the ideas was, well, what if it's kind of noisy in there and, too much crowd noise? Well, on that Tuesday, the place was packed, and it was like a concert hall. And these are not like, music. These are not necessarily jazz musicians or music ethnologists or anything like that. They're just common folks that are kind of understanding that we have some integrity of what we're doing. And so probably that if there's anything about jazz, the stuff that's going to survive and flourish is the stuff with the 100% integrity, that it's not a way of making, commercial. I mean, I think a little bit in the 70s, you were saying, Clay, some of the jazz musicians were saying, maybe you got to put a rock beat to our thing, and people didn't like that at the time. Now I love going back and listening to that old CTI stuff. It's blast. Yes,
totally.
You know, no, I think the stuff that people are playing that has integrity, that they really believe in it, it's going to get attention. It's going to continue. But you're right, Clay, it's going to change. That's the nature of the music.
Yeah, and in terms of that, you know, I mean, obvious, you know, some obvious choices for where the direction is heading is like, you know, this complexity of odd meters. You know, somebody like Logan Richardson, who's playing these, you know, each bar is 15, 16, and then 11, 8, and whatever it is, you know, it's that might be one direction. I don't know. That to me, even that is already seeming done. Maybe like even 10 years ago, they were already doing that. So I really, you know, I wouldn't venture a guess as to where, yeah, maybe electronics holds some promise, but even just the end of, you know, the individuality of each person on each instrument and what somebody say can bring to the bass, you know, it's so unique. So that's kind of where I think, you know, just finding out who you are on the instrument and creating that and bringing that out in the world. That's all you can do. Anyway, that's what I think.
Yeah. So it's not necessarily about this continual climb of technical proficiency or, you know, mathematical precision. It's about, it's about what's inside.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, what is your personality? What is your take on your instrument and the language and the music? Yeah.
Yes. And on this particular tune in this particular moment, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah.
Well, Dave Bayless, Clay Schaub, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation. I'm really looking forward to your trio show here in Madison coming up May 26th.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Michael. And thank you for helping this music too, man. Not only as a player, but in this podcast format as well. It's all important. So thank you.
That's it for this edition of the Showbiz Roundup. Our theme music is a composition by me, performed by Outside the Sphere, an experimental duo consisting of Tony Barba and myself, with special guest Sebastian Brennis on trombone. If you'd like more information about this show or any of the past or future shows presented by Bluestem Jazz, you can head over to bluestemjazz.org, and you can follow my doings or be in touch via rattletickbuzz.com. Catch you later.